Hi everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. It's always wonderful having you join me on these shows and the opportunities to have wonderful, inspiring conversations that I trust will uplift you and empower you so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. We have a great interview scheduled today, a wonderful conversation. I'm really looking forward to it. And I just want to say before we jump into that, that I encourage you all to go over to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com. I have special reports there for you. I have many articles, a lot of great educational information. So please avail yourself of the opportunity to keep learning. And also go over to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, because I post there on a daily basis great information of all sorts of things and inspiration and recipes and kind of the leading edge news that relates to your health and well-being. So take advantage because it is all about getting empowered with truthful information. Well, today, we're going to be continuing our conversation of getting empowered because I'm very thrilled to be able to bring to the show today a wonderful man, Dr. Bernie Siegel. We're going to be talking about how to ignite the spirit of hope and gratitude in your life. Just a little bit about Dr. Siegel. Bernie Siegel is a retired surgeon who is now involved in humanizing medical care and medical education. He embraces a philosophy that is at the forefront of a society grappling with medical ethics and spiritual issues. He, in 1978, originated exceptional cancer patients, a specific form of individual and group therapy. He is the author of Love, Medicine, and Miracles, Peace, Love, and Healing, How to Live Between Office Visits, Prescriptions for Living, and Help Me to Heal. And his latest book is A Book of Miracles, Inspiring True Stories of Healing, Gratitude, and Love. Over the span of 20 years, physicians have become increasingly more receptive to his message. And in May of 2011, Bernie was honored by the Watkins Review of London, England, as one of the top 20 spiritually influential living people on the planet. He continues to travel extensively with his wife, Bobby, to speak and run workshops, sharing his techniques and experiences. Bernie lives in Connecticut and has 5 children and 8 grandchildren so far. And his website is drberniesiegel.com. And it is such a pleasure to have you on the show today, Bernie. Thank you for being here.
Well, my pleasure.
Well, as I was saying before we started this show, I've read your book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, way back in the 1980s, 86 when it first came out. It had such an impact on me. And what I was also sharing with you that, you know, I mean, that was a long time ago. I've read a lot of books between then and now. But there was one thing that I've always remembered. I'm sure there was more than one. But there was one thing that really, really stayed with me. And that was when you talked about how you it's not so much the treatment that you get. You talked about when people do the drawings and kind of a way to communicate with your unconscious, that some people, through their unconscious communication, really need to do or will thrive best with chemotherapy. Others will thrive best with an alternative approach. And that is what was so profound, that we don't know what the best healing path is for anyone. We are learning how to find it for ourselves, and we have to be open because there are many, many paths to healing. And I just remembered that inspiration and those words of wisdom. So, you know, I just am really enjoying our time and look forward to our conversation today. That's still a major piece when you do your work, isn't it? It's like working with the unconscious, what the real intuitive direction is within a person's journey.
I always say I'm a multiple personality. We all are. But what I found was that, see, you might come in and say, you know, I'm going to eat a special diet with vegetables to get well. And you hand me a picture when I say, well, draw, you know, yourself eating that food and let me see what it looks like. And the picture's horrible. I mean, one man, literally, everybody in the kitchen had their head at the bottom of the page. And I said, this is crazy. You're all standing on your head. He said, I can't stand it anymore. My wife doesn't like preparing it, and the kids won't eat with us. I said, you know, you could have an operation if you wanted one. It was like, oh, really? You know, like I was doing him a favor, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's the part I try to get people to understand. And, well, let me say the other side, too. There are people who hear from doctors about chemotherapy and say, no, I don't want it, and draw a beautiful picture of this golden light flowing into their body right to their disease. And other people draw the devil giving me poison as chemotherapy. Now, how you respond is going to be related to that unconscious, intuitive wisdom that's within you. And I tell people, if you're in conflict, then you're going to have trouble. So if your head is saying, you better go do what the doctor told you, but your intuitive wisdom is saying, this is not the right thing for you, you're going to have every side effect in the book. But when the two of them agree, you know, that your head and your heart, in a sense, both say, this is the right choice for us, then you will go through it. Well, as one lady said about radiation, I get out of the way, I let it go to my tumor. Because the radiation therapist thought the machine was broken. She had no side effects of radiation at all. And then he said, well, I saw your name in the chart, meaning he saw Dr. Siegel in the chart. He said, so I knew it was a crazy patient. It wasn't my machine. And then he said to her, why don't you have any reaction? She said, I just get out of the way. Now, let me also say, in a sense, the positive side, how powerful the mind is, there are people who were not being radiated because they had repaired the machine and didn't put the radioactive material back in. And the radiation therapist told me this because he said, I'm feeling terrible. I just inspected the machine, which we do, you know, once a month, and there was no radioactive material, and I don't know, I didn't treat any. I said, calm down. You're not to blame. You don't understand. I said, what do you mean I don't understand? I said, look, you're not an idiot. If there were no material in the machine and the patients reacted as if there was no material, you'd know it in a week. Nobody's having any effect. But they all acted as if they were being treated because they thought they were. They believed they were being treated. So they had side effects and shrinking tumors, and you didn't know they weren't being treated. And his eyes almost popped out of his head. You know, oh my God, you're right. That impresses the hell out of me. You know, that people think they're being treated, mm-hmm. and they act as if they are. I mean, benefits and side effects, but that's how powerful and why doctors need to incorporate that belief. As a matter of fact, on my website, I wrote an article. The website is Bernie Siegel, SIEGELMD.com, but it's called Deceiving People into Health. Now, would you get upset with me if I lied to you and you got well? I don't think so. And, you know, on a simple level, what I mean is, I would say to parents, I did a lot of children's surgery, get a bottle of vitamins, label it, you know, whatever you want your child to experience in terms of benefits. So it could say hair growing pill, anti-nausea pill, pain pill, it doesn't matter what, energy pill. Because when the parents and I give it to a child, they believe in us, and they all feel better. And the reason I started doing that is really I saw how the children responded to things I said, and I realized they're being hypnotized by what I think is a fact. You'll go to sleep when you go in the operating room. I'm trying to reassure the child. They won't have pain. They'll be okay. And they fell asleep when we wheeled them in to the operating room. I mean, literally, on the stretcher that we're wheeling them in on, they would turn over and go to sleep. And it got to be a joke. The people in the operating room would burst out laughing because they had seen this happen so many times. And so I began to use those words, in a sense, in a positive way. And I may add, the opposite is true, too, because one of our kids on a canvas in an art class wrote words, 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 words. He filled this big canvas, like 2 by 3 feet in size, with just words. And you realize they become swords.
Mm.
Words,
you know,
words, words. Swords,
you know,
swords, swords.
You talk about the importance of change and change that comes from the inside out.
Mm.
So I wanted to ask you, what was for you the change that came from the inside out that transformed your whole consciousness around health and healing and turned you from that traditional orthodox medical surgeon into someone who is really delving more deeply into the power of healing and love?
Yeah. I think it's a problem with every profession. I always say, I became a doctor for healthy reasons. I liked people. I was an artist as a child. I wanted to use my hands because I didn't know artists earned a living. It may sound crazy, but I could easily have become an artist if I'd known you could earn a living as an artist. I didn't know it was a profession. So I thought, I want to use my hands. I like people, like fixing things. Science is interesting. But number one was I like people. Because many students write, I'm fascinated by the human body on their application. But people come in the body. Hey, think of a Kevorkian. I mean, if he had had time to analyze himself with help from the medical school, he might have understood, why do you want to be a pathologist? Why is death a big issue in your life? And then, I always say, he could have ended up running a hospice. You see, in other words, getting involved in a healthy way rather than killing people and ending up in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a big problem in medical schools, that they don't really help people know the healthy and unhealthy reasons for choosing their profession. And I say it's no different in any profession. You know, the policeman, say, who wants to carry a gun. I always tell people that and this came again from Carl Menninger, the psychiatrist. He said, Bernie, what if you became a surgeon as a reaction formation to your destructive tendencies? So, you know, I laugh, but I love that. When people say, why did you become a surgeon? I said, I like cutting people up, but I don't want to end up in prison. So I figure, hey, I'll get paid for it. But, you know, and you could become a policeman for the same reason. I want to carry a gun. You know, I'm tough, but I don't want to be a criminal. But they may be more violent and do more damage to people, you know, all the headlines we read. And the same thing with some surgeons who, you know, cut people up for unhealthy reasons. So we have to know ourselves, no matter what profession. But what changed me and helped me, see, as a doctor, what did I realize? I want to help people. Then I realized you can't help everybody. You can't fix everything. People die. Some of them even have complications of your operation. You make an error, you know. And believe me, I told several of my patients, I'm retiring, I'm quitting, because I felt so guilty and so terrible when they had complications of surgery. You know, if I'd been a perfect human being, they'd be okay. Every one of them said to me, no, calm down, you're not going to retire. Because they knew I was in pain and they helped me.
Mm-hmm.
But the person who helped me most, I went to a medical conference run by Dr. Carl Simonton. This was back in the mid-70s. He wrote Getting Well Again. He was helping cancer patients with imagery and other things. And I thought, good, that'll give me more tools. I thought it was literally a conference for doctors. He's a radiation therapist. I was the only doctor out of 125 people in the room. I couldn't believe that not one other doctor in the state of Connecticut attended. But see, now I had no desk. I'm sitting in the audience, and I'm surrounded by my own patients. And one of them said to me, you're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits. That literally was the redirection of my life. I thought, okay, if I can help people live, then I've done everybody. You know, I've benefited everybody. Even if I don't cure their disease, I help them live. And then again, what's your next awakening? You assume everybody wants to live. So you send out 100 letters. You want to live a longer, better life? Come to a meeting. I expected several hundred people to show up. I was literally a nervous wreck trying to think, what am I going to do with them all? Less than a dozen women came to the first meeting. And then I also woke up and said, you don't know the people you're taking care of. You want them to live a longer, better life, and they don't show up. So I began to get into their lives and to understand them. See, there's a sentence I read recently that said, doctors are trained to treat the result, but not the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I woke up to, you know, to get into the cause. Why are you not coming? How do you feel about your life? And what I also saw, to make a long story short, is that when you help people live, they didn't die when they were supposed to. You know, it's like recently, this young woman who was going to go to Oregon to end her life because she has a brain tumor, and then she's changed her mind, it said on the news. But, see, I know people like her who went to where it was beautiful to die. I mean, this literally, I don't make up any of these stories. The mountains of Colorado, buying a house on the ocean in Florida. See, they went there to enjoy that time. That's where they wanted to be with the time they had left. They didn't go there to end their life. They went there to enjoy it. And I start laughing when I tell you about it because when you call up and ask the family, why wasn't I invited to the funeral? And the person who you think is dead answers the phone and says, it was so beautiful here, I forgot to die. That's a quote from a guy in the mountains of Colorado. And the other, the fellow in Florida, his wife said, you will get a house on the ocean, you'll listen to Bernie's tapes, you'll meditate. Instead of being dead in 2 months, he lived 5.5 years. And that's what I began to see. And see, I learned from these people. Most doctors, I hear this all the time, you're doing very well. Say, why don't they say, how come you're doing so well? Tell me, what are you doing? I want to tell the other patients. Instead of saying, you're doing very well, keep it up. Learn. See, I learned from success. I would say to people, hey, how come you didn't die when you were supposed to? And they all had stories. And what's interesting, go ahead. All right.
I was going to say, why is that, Bernie? I know so many people who have had amazing recoveries, you know, from surgeries, from illnesses. They go to their doctor, and their doctor goes, okay, very interesting. See you next week or next year or whatever. What is that about the medical profession
where they have lost
curiosity?
Well, think of it this way. You come in to, you know, your plumber, and you want to tell them a story about electricity. And they say, it's interesting. We'll see you next week, you know. We're so specialized that we're, again, treating the body and the disease, not the person. And there's an ad from Sandoz Pharmaceutical in New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago. I'm depressed, unable to cope. I went to see my physician. I said, you've got to help me. He prescribed an antidepressant. I feel better now. I wrote them. I said, excuse me, I'm depressed because of tragedy in my family, and the doctor doesn't even ask me why you're depressed, what's happening in your life. Couldn't you put that line in? And they canceled the ad. But you see, yeah, the doctor's focused on your disease, your problem, not what you're doing in your life. But I learned, as I say, the poets, the songwriters, they all, see, they're watching the world, and they write in their poetry and in their songs about life. And I've recited those things and had doctors say to me, just because it rhymes doesn't make it true. But see, now, decades later, this had to do with, you know, childless women, men when they're retiring, you know, more likely to develop cancer. See, but when you go 30 years, then you have studies showing loneliness affects the genes that control immune function.
Yes.
But you see, when you bring these things up too often, I was criticized for not doing research. But every time I'd want to do research, they'd say, well, that doesn't make sense. We don't believe, you know, what you want to research has any truth in it, so we're not funding you. Or they'd give you 6 inches height, you know, piles of papers to fill out. I mean, I don't have a month to fill out papers or an office full of secretaries who are going to do it for me. So you get criticized for not doing it, and then they don't want to support you when you want to do it. The ones who helped were often graduate students. They would do research for their master's degree, and it would always come out supporting me. But listen, see, that's the trouble with what I call belief versus experience. I live by my experience. I don't let beliefs block my mind so I don't, you know, open it to be able to accept things. But one student showed the benefits of our support groups in survival and women with breast cancer. His professor said to him, "This can't be true." I mean, what kind of college professor would say that to a student? But he doesn't believe it, so he says, "It can't be true. Change the control group so it comes out even." You know, and then people say, "Oh, look, it didn't prove that you were right." They don't know what the professor said. But when the shift began was when a psychiatrist, Spiegel, I think it was David Spiegel, out in California, thought I was nuts, that why would it make a difference to sit in a group and, you know, share things in your life? And he did a study, and it came out I was right. Now, what's interesting, see, he published it, and it shifted him and how he helped cancer patients. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't deny his results, you know, that the control group versus the women who were in his support group with breast cancer lived longer. And many of them at the end of the study were still alive when they weren't supposed to be. So then you see people begin to think, oh, maybe it's true. Because somebody who's trying to prove me wrong comes out the other way and is honest enough to accept it and publish it, then it became meaningful.
Well, you kind of got even because you've written all these 12 or more books. You've touched lives of millions and millions of people. So your message has gotten out to many more than if you had a published study anyway.
Yeah, I think the good thing about the conflict was you get on all the famous talk shows. but they don't tell you they're going to have somebody there to argue with you. That's why I used to get a kick. You know, it's like Oprah will call you up and say, "Would you like to be on our show?" "Oh, yeah, I'd like to talk about what I'm doing." And you get there, and there are three other doctors sitting there telling you, "You don't know what you're doing."
Well, you probably enjoyed that, Bernie.
Oh, I learned, yeah, to not fight. Because the audience was always nodding their head, agreeing with me, you know, not the other doctors. Because they were living the experience, and the doctors weren't.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something, though, that I was really impressed with Phil Donahue, because we flew out to Chicago, three women with cancer and myself. You come into the studio, and he put the three women with cancer up on the stage. I was put in the audience, and I really admired him, because I said, "You're right. I'm not the star. I'm not the expert. They are, and they're the ones who are teaching me."
Right.
Oh, and you see, you talk about life. One of the women who flew to Chicago with cancer, who's supposed to die, met a former boyfriend, didn't come back to Connecticut with us, stayed and got married, and her cancer didn't, you know, recur. So years later, she's feeling fine, doing all kinds of things. And that trip to Chicago, I think, in a sense, saved her life, meeting her old boyfriend and getting married.
So with your years of work, getting people to be present with people, really, it's being present, letting people share, having a communion of, you know, beings together, right, listening. What is your message to people as to helping them understand the journey that a disease experience that's present in their life has to offer them?
Good question. I've learned from several things. An animal intuitive friend, Joseph Campbell, and others. And I'll tell you why I mention all these, you know, how these things all come together. In reading Joseph Campbell, he said, when you're going through hell, ask yourself, what am I to learn from this experience? A friend of mine said, "Do you get upset when you're hungry?" I said, "No." "What do you do?" "I get something to eat." "Then ask yourself what nourishment you need to bring into your life. My animal intuitive friend said, Bernie, if you're running around screaming your pet's name, you're never going to communicate with them. You're not getting into their mind. It's never going to work. Quiet your mind. Quiet your mind, then you'll know where they are and what they're thinking. And to me, they're all telling me the same thing. And the myth is about the still pond, where the ugly duckling sees he's a swan. The tiger brought up by goats is taken to a pond, again, by a tiger, and says, look, dumbbell, you're a tiger, not a goat. And they're all, in a sense, saying the same thing, that you need to quiet your mind, know your true self, and live that life. Create what I call a life you can love and also love your body. Don't get angry at it, because it's threatening you. And to realize with that kind of quiet mind and faith, your body gets a different message. It gets a live message. And the potential is there. I always say our Creator loves us. I mean, He has built into every living thing mechanisms for survival. You know, the bacteria resist antibiotics by altering genes. Trees send out an aroma, so birds come over and eat the, you know, insects that are infecting the tree. I mean, I read amazing things. Well, we cut our finger, and what happens? It heals. Mm. So it's built into us. But our problem is we have a mind that thinks and our body that feels, and that's a lot more complicated to give it that kind of message and stop, you know, the still pond. If you wake up with turbulence, what am I going to do today? Oh, my God, I did. Oh, you know, I'm mad. My family doesn't love me. You're never going to find that true self. So you're never going to see the swan. You're always seeing the ugly duckling. And believe me, I always say the biggest public health issue is not being loved by parents, teachers, clergy, you know, all the authority figures in your life. That they let you know you're a failure, you're embarrassing them, you don't do anything right, that really takes your life away. And studies have shown this. I mean, those who feel unloved, yes, they're the ones who become the addicts. They're the ones who by middle age have 100% of them have had a major illness in their life. I always say, I mean, think about it, you know, that politicians saying, take sugar out of the soda, put a sign, you know, a label on cigarettes, they're no good for you. Everybody knows that. You know, why do we need a sign? And the sign doesn't do any good either. It doesn't stop you from being self-destructive. What we need to do is help people feel worthy and loved so they say, I'm worth something. I'm going to take care of myself. I saw that with patients. One of them taught me something. She was a suicidal teenager who said to me, you're my CD. I said, what are you talking about? I'm a CD. You're my chosen dad. And boy, she woke me up to the effect I was having on people. I didn't give up on them. What I mean by that is the opposite of love is indifference, rejection, and abuse. You get that from your parents. You go to see a doctor. The doctor says, you're not taking care of yourself. You don't do what I tell you. I'm not giving you a return appointment. No point. But I would give everybody return appointments. I mean, I don't care how they would, you know, treating themselves. And I kept it up because I'd learned that if I keep it up long enough, they begin to think, what's the matter with him? Maybe there isn't anything the matter with him. Maybe I'm worth something. And he's seeing something in me that nobody else sees. And then they begin to take care of themselves. And,
really what unconditional love is all about.
And I always say, it doesn't mean I like what they're doing. And it doesn't mean I can't express anger, you know, but they know they're loved.
Right.
So those are healthy emotions. And I loved it when people got angry at me, even through my books in the wastebasket in the hospital. I'd come in, smile and laugh and say, that looks good. And then this patient said to me, The nurse told me you were going to say that. I said, yeah, because if you're angry, it's energy. Let's use it, you know? I said, if you were lying here under the covers, depressed and crying, what am I going to do? I got nothing. Yeah.
This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know. And today we are so blessed. We have Dr. Bernie Siegel with us. He is sharing with us stories of hope, gratitude, how to bring more miracles in your life. And his latest book is A Book of Miracles, Inspiring True Stories of Healing, Gratitude, and Love. So, Bernie, I asked you before the break to share with us some of perhaps some practical steps or some thoughts that you can offer people who are going through some of the challenges that life is presenting to them.
Yeah. Again, psychologists have learned this. That there's, you could predict people's health and how they'll respond to illness from their personalities, both from pictures they draw as well as filling out personality profiles. You can literally predict what's going to happen to them because they're showing what parts of them are vulnerable. And I may add, I have another book, The Art of Healing, which has 60 drawings in it, which thrilled me, you know, the publishers would do this, so people can look at it and know. So I'd say combine those two books, you know, A Book of Miracles and The Art of Healing, and it'll get you on the right path. But to get back to your question, first I want to say this to the women. You know, one of my articles on my website is, what does every woman want? See, women live longer than men with the same cancers, and married men longer than single men. So relationships are a factor in survival. But too many women, you see, will identify themselves by their role. You know, I'm a wife, I'm a mother. Well, the husband dies, the kids leave home, then mama dies. And I mean it, the cancer comes back. And so I want the women to take care of themselves and see themselves as one of their children, so to speak, and be as good to yourself as you are to your children. There's a story that I often say and make it personal, that I married a woman who was just, I can't explain how ugly she was, and I was forced to do it. But that night, I go in the bathroom when we're in our hotel, the first night we're married, and I'm thinking, how can I, you know, be nice to this woman? I was forced into this, but I don't want to be mean and cruel. And I sit in the bathroom for a couple hours, and finally I say, okay, take a breath and go out. And I walk out, and there's a gorgeous woman sitting on the bed. I said, where's my wife? She said, it's me. I'm a beautiful woman 12 hours, and I'm a witch 12 hours. What schedule you want me to be on? I said, look, dear, it's your life. You decide. And she said, thank you. I can be a beautiful woman 24 hours a day now. You freed me from the spell. So I would say to women, remember, this is your life. Mm-hmm. Don't let others impose a life on you. Otherwise, they're taking your life. Now, on my website is also an immune competent personality. What would I want you to do? How do you? I want you to behave. I want you to have a sense of meaning in your life, but not living a role, see? Men, on the other hand, aren't about relationships. I've had guys in the office with their wife and children sitting there say, there's no point in living, I can't work anymore. And I've had their kids call me and say, I can't talk to my father. He just keeps working all the time, you know, even at home with computers and everything. And, you know, you're talking about somebody with a life-threatening illness. So have meaning in your life. Don't live a role. It's appropriate to express anger when you're not treated with respect. It's appropriate to ask for help from family and friends when you need it. And nurses have a lot of trouble with that because I often say you ask your friends and family for help and you don't want to do what they're asking of you. What do you tell them? 98% of the nurses say, well, I'd go and do it. But then you're saying no to yourself. So think about it in a different way. If people ask you to do something you don't want to do, it's okay to say no. But it's also okay to ask them to help you because they have a right to say no and not to, you know, keep your problems to yourself so I don't upset my family. That's not survival. Mm-hmm. I get so involved I forget all the things I'm saying.
Oh, we were talking about some strategies.
Yeah, no, I know that, but I mean the list, you know, it's my mind. I have so many people. It's, you know, like as I said, I was an artist as a child, so I'm always seeing images, and then I would lose track of the script, so to speak. But, you know, that you participate in choices about your life. I always say, see life as a labor pain. Don't let others impose the pain upon you. Have play in your life. To me, the best definition of that is what makes you lose track of time? Go do it. Yeah. Then you're in a trance state. It's so healthy. And one of our sons put it very well. I was talking to a group. I said, you have 15 minutes to live. What would you do? And I heard some answers that I couldn't believe. But he said, I'd buy a quart of chocolate ice cream and eat it. I said, you're good. I don't have to worry. But somebody in the audience then enlightened me. He said, wait a minute. You're critical of me. But what if what I told you is my chocolate ice cream? So now I don't have any problems with the answers people give me. Yeah. You know, you don't have to call everybody and say, I love you. You want to go play golf? Go ahead. Because that's your chocolate ice cream.
Yeah.
You know, we mentioned this one earlier, but it's when you're going through difficult times and depression, you use it, you know, to nourish yourself and change your life and ask for what you need. I always say charcoal under pressure becomes a diamond. So you can turn the curse into a blessing if you use it. And a way of doing it, too, is whatever problem you have, ask yourself, what words would I use to describe this to someone else? In other words, to describe what I'm going through. If you said, I have carcinoma of the colon, I said, that's not a feeling word. That's your diagnosis. But if you said, oh, draining, pressure, failure, then I'd say, what else in your life fits those words? Eliminate them, it'll help you to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And the last is, I say, that I mentioned earlier, do not live a role in your life. Don't be the wage earner, mama, or whatever. I always say, how would you introduce yourself to God? Because if you say, I'm a mother, I'm a lawyer, God says, come back when you know who you are. But when you can look at God and say, hey, I'm your kid, you see, or it's you, I'm part of you. Then God says, come on in. So to accept the divine in you, that doesn't mean you're perfect. None of us are perfect. Because if everything were perfect, this is something I learned from talking to God, because I often say to people, okay, you can be God for a day. Why would you want to be God? And most people say, I don't think I want that job. But others will say, oh, I fix this and stop the war and do this. And yeah, but is that the right answer? No. The best reason for being God for a day is to understand why. To understand why. And what's the why? Why didn't God make a perfect world? Because a perfect world is not creation. And we'd all be going nuts in a week if everything were perfect. I mean that literally. Just imagine the evening news. There isn't any. You know, hey, good weather. Everybody loves everybody. That's it, folks. So, you know, we're here to give our life meaning. I now see life as a school. I'm going to school. And for me, and I mean this literally, death is the commencement, like the graduation. But learn everything you can so your consciousness moves up, you know, and you become a postgraduate student. Then your consciousness will go on when your body dies and make the world a better place. But if we all, you know, stay in kindergarten fighting with each other, yelling and arguing, the world is going to remain the way it is.
So would you say that whatever challenges we may find ourselves dealing with, we need to shift our perception from one of feeling victimized by life or others or our condition and learn to see how this is a catalyst for a profound transformation.
Right.
To be free.
See, what we're in control of is what's going on in our mind. Mm. I mean, I get more emails from people with all kinds of diseases and problems and family, and I keep telling them, they're not creating your thoughts. You are. And I emailed somebody this morning because it's a true story about a blind woman who was wheeled into a nursing home. And she said, oh, what a lovely place. And everybody said to her, excuse me, you're blind. What are you talking about? You don't even see. She said, excuse me, I decide what I see. And boy, that line means a lot to me. And I know when I have difficulties, and this is something else I've learned from a story I was reading. A college professor was complaining that his work was always interrupted. And then one day he said, I realized something. The interruptions are my work. And boy, that helped me enormously too. So when my life is interrupted, and by that, you know, I'm just talking about everyday things. The furnace won't work. The car won't start. Somebody gets sick. I mean, you get a phone call, whatever. But stop and say, okay, what am I to learn from this? How is this interruption going to become part of my education? You know, rather than just spending your time being bitter and resentful, which doesn't accomplish anything about, you know, I'm interrupted. But the interruption is your work. Another way I say thinking about it is there are spiritual flat tires. You know, that when you get a flat on the way to the airport and miss a plane that crashes, now you're thankful. You're not cursing the tire and what happened. You're thrilled that you had it. And so think of the flat, you know, these effects in your life. And if we have a moment, just let me say it in a practical way. My wife has had a long history of multiple sclerosis, and she has some disabilities now. And again, I learned, you know, what I was told was going to happen to her hasn't. I mean, she's been, we've been together for a lifetime. But anyway, she'll say to me, honey, get me a glass of water. And I'll say, you need to be more active, so you get up and get the water. Now, that doesn't make her happy, and that doesn't make me feel good. See, that's when I'm being the doctor. I'm prescribing for her. But I said to myself one day, hey, what are you to learn from this, you know, your reaction? And I realized you should be more compassionate when she needs something or wants something. And I thought, yeah, that sounds good. And so, honey, get me a glass of water. Okay, here, sweetheart. And then you get a kiss and a hug and everybody feels good. And those little things can be your teacher. You know, the everyday moments, just stop and think about your actions and how they are, you know, you define them and how others feel about them. Because love benefits the giver and the receiver, you know. And if it's really love, I don't mean you're feeling a burden and I got to do this. No, that's not what I'm talking about. It's listening to people. That's something else Helen Keller taught me. She said, deafness is darker by far than blindness. So listen to yourself, too. Keep a journal of your feelings and emotions, and the good feelings, too. Don't forget them. Because my wife reminded me one day when she found my journal hidden away that I forgot to hide one night, that there was nothing funny in it. And she made me aware of all the jokes I would tell them at dinner time about things that happened in the hospital that were funny, that never were written about in my journal. So keep the journal of all your feelings and listen to others, because when you listen to them, they hear themselves and you get credit for whatever wonderful conclusion they come to.
Bernie, I was listening to Bruce Lipton recently, and
yes.
His message is so similar to yours. You just have your own unique ways of communicating it. And what really struck me, what he was saying, when we get to this place where we can be in this in a state of more acceptance, when we can, you know, have an adventurous attitude, our immune system is actually more active. It's switched on, as opposed to being in survival, fear, shutdown mode. And I think that's really part of this transformation that you write about over and over and over again with people, as they take on the challenge to find the gifts and healing in the school of life. They actually allow their immune systems to be functioning.
Let me make it practical. Yeah, because Lipton and I talked years ago when he was about to write his book, and he was very happy that I agreed with him and he agreed with me.
It's always nice.
You see, again, this was done by a graduate student. You take two actors, male, female, gave them a comedy script, and he drew their blood while they were reading the script. Their immune function went up while they're doing the comedy. Stress hormone levels went down when they were doing the tragedy. Then he gave them a script where the male had murdered the woman's husband, and they meet, and they're reading this script, and their immune function went down, stress hormone levels went up. That impressed the hell out of me, because this was done down at the University of South Florida, where, I mean, they're just acting. But you see this happen on Broadway, too. You know, if you're in Death of a Salesman, you don't make it through the winter because of what that part does to you. And this has happened. I mean, don't make up these stories. But if you're in a Mel Brooks production, you go on for years and, you know, you don't get sick. So it does. It affects us. The epigenetics, what Lipton is talking about, genes don't make the decision. They are communicated with and turned on and off. I always say like a light switch. Somebody's got to flip the switch, and that has to do with emotions and the internal chemistry that you create. So twin sisters who have a gene for breast cancer, who's more likely to get it? The little devil who's driving everybody nuts, doing her thing, or the sweet one who's making mommy and daddy happy and internalizing her anger? And the answer is the good kid, you know, who's trying to please everybody, because she's giving up her life, and she's more likely to develop breast cancer. And every audience will vote for, you know, that girl. When you say who's more likely to get sick, they all know from their own lives.
So the thing that concerns me is the everyday news that we are subjected to. If there is one fear-inducing experience that we are fed day in and day out, it's the news.
Yeah. I mean, look at this Ebola thing. I mean, how it's taken over. I mean, everybody's so afraid. And, you know, stay in the house 21 days. And, you know, it's just, you can't let fear be what controls your life. Because, again, yeah, you become more likely to get sick.
You know, shut down.
If you look back at mankind, no disease has ever wiped out human beings. We're still here, you know. I mean, decades, many ago, the flu epidemic and all these things happen. So we're always going to have some threat to our health. The key is, how do we remain resistant? I always say we should learn from the people who don't get sick, the people who don't die when they're supposed to. You know, and not live in that fear, because that makes you more vulnerable to all this happening. You know, when I mentioned you in our life, I mean, my wife with MS, she, I always blame her. She had twins and five children in 7 years. I mean, we both got sick. We were exhausted caring for our children whom we loved. And that woke me up back in those years, too, to say, hey, the reason we're having a problem is we're up day and night, you know, cleaning, caring, feeding, and doing. And so then you reach out and ask for help, you know, on that immune-competent personality. You ask friends and family. I mean, we had neighbors, teenagers, patients would come over and help us out. And that's what people have to realize. Ask for help when you need it. But also, don't hide your wounds. Another important lesson is, it's a quote from Thornton Wilder, in love service, only the wounded soldier can serve. And a doctor who's refused healing by an angel realizes he's a very effective doctor because he's got problems, and that the angel's not being mean to him by not curing him. But as the angel said, you know, without your wound, where would your power be? So I always tell people, put a bandage over your eye and go shopping and watch how everybody reacts to you. Or go to work, you know, or school that way. Because I've had people poke me in the back and say, you didn't ask me what happened. I mean, it is a total stranger, you know, in Stop and Shop saying, you didn't ask me what happened. And I have to tell you my sense of humor. I said, I know what happened. I have an abusive spouse also. And they don't know what to do with me. But I said, I'm a doctor, so when I see a bandage, I don't immediately say, oh, there's a wounded person I can go talk to. But I know when I shaved my head back in the 70s, okay, and went to the hospital with a shaved head, everybody, when I say everybody, 15, 20 people would line up and want to talk to me when I'd go make rounds on my patients. They'd say, can we talk to you? And I thought, what's going on here? But I realized they know you have a problem. Look what you've done. You know, the kids, the boys are wearing the hair down to their shoulders, and you've shaved your head, so you got something going on. And I realized the benefits of having a wound and letting, you know, and sharing it with people.
And is that why you've continued to shave your head?
Oh, no. What I learned
was... Is it just a
habit
now?
No, it's not. I know what it... I mean, I didn't understand why I had to shave it. And again, I call myself a Jungian surgeon because I'm reading Carl Jung. And what does he describe? The hero's head is shaved, called the tonsure, T-O-N-S-U-R-E. It's what monks undergo to uncover their spirituality, and it's like becoming that infant again. When I read that, it was, it just brought me home. Mm. It was like, thank you. Now I know what was within me. See, we've been talking about unconscious spirit inside us and intellect. I didn't know why I shaved my head until I read that. And then it was like, yes, the truth that was in me, what my unconscious was driving me to do was to uncover my spirituality and my emotions and my feelings, all these things.
Yeah.
Because when I drew a picture for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at the same time, she said to me, Bernie, what are you covering up? Now, it never occurred to me that those were part of the same thing. But I had used a white crayon to make snow on a mountain. And she said, Bernie, the page is already white. What's the point of taking a white crayon? What are you covering up?
Oh, yeah.
And so profound. I had to uncover what was within me. It was more than just shaving my head.
Right. Well, we've actually arrived at the end of the show, which has been so fascinating, Bernie. Always goes so fast, doesn't it?
Thank you.
Time flies when you are inspiring. It's just been such a pleasure. I am so grateful to have you on the show. I'm so grateful for your journey and for all the experiences that you share with us, because there's something magical when we all share inspirational stories.
Let
we
me
all
add
have
this.
Them.
You just said something very important. A friend of mine was at hospice and started calling me Journey instead of Bernie. And you just used that word, journey. And I'd say to everybody, we're all on a journey. You know, we're here to live and to learn. So enjoy your journey.
Well, you are certainly helping to make all of our journeys more meaningful and more joyful. So thank you, Dr. Bernie Siegel, for being with us today.
Thank you, Cheryl.
And to all of you, thank you again for joining me on this journey of expanded awareness and empowerment. This is Dr. Cheryl Sullman. You've been listening to What Women Must Know with my guest today, Dr. Bernie Siegel, who has a fantastic new book. I recommend it, called A Book of Miracles, Inspiring True Stories of Healing, Gratitude, and Love. Great read. And until next time, remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.